This podcast is sponsored by Athletic Greens. Now, you've probably heard of Athletic Greens from 1,000 different podcasts, and the reason why I believe is because it works. This is something I've been using every single day, and the biggest things that I've realized for myself is that I have more energy, I rarely if ever get sick, my poops are better, okay? There's multiple benefits here, and if you are interested in trying it, I have a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 AG1 travel packs by using the link drinkag1.com/Farzad. And my gut tells me, no pun intended, that you're going to love this product. Now onto the podcast. We'll start by having you maybe give us a little bit of an introduction, the group that you're working with, some of the research you've done, and then we'll turn this into a giant nerd fest. So Adam, I'll give you the floor.
Thanks. Well, hey, thanks for having me here, first of all, Farzad and Hans. It's great to talk to you guys again. So I'm Adam Dorr. I'm the director of research at RethinkX. And RethinkX is an independent research organization founded by Tony Seba. Tony is probably a name that many of the folks listening will be familiar with. He's one of the godfathers of technology disruption. He's been phenomenally accurate over the last 15 plus years in forecasting, analyzing and forecasting technology disruption. And over the last, I've been with RethinkX for almost 7 years now. God, the time flies. And we've published on major disruptions. They were originally coming, now they're here, in energy, transportation, and food. And as if those three alone weren't, world-changing, world-transforming enough, we've now just dipped our toes into the fourth major disruption domain, the disruption of labor by artificial intelligence and robotics. And so it's a crazy, crazy time, because we have not just one of these transformative changes in the offing, but four of them. And so it's really pretty extraordinary. I'm very fortunate to be able to spend my time as a scientist focusing on trying to understand the dynamics of what's going on here. And you'll probably hear me multiple times in any given conversation like this, struggling to find words to express how totally profound any one of these four disruptions would be. But all four of them simultaneously, to my knowledge, in my team's knowledge, this is an unprecedented moment in human history. We've never had so much foundational change occurring simultaneously. And my team's looked at hundreds of technology disruptions and more than 1,000 cases of technological innovation and transformation over the entire course of human history, right back to Neolithic arrowheads. And they all show the same pattern. We see the same underlying dynamics again and again and again. You guys will be familiar with, your sigmoid, your S-shaped adoption curves, and disruption happens swiftly. It doesn't take 500 years or 100 years for a new technology to be adopted and become widespread. It only takes 15 to 20 years typically. And so the idea that we're going to see these changes in four such foundational domains simultaneously over the next two decades is frankly pretty mind-blowing. So I have the fun job of trying to wrap my head around all of that and try to make sense of it. And I hope that it's both interesting and informative, but also useful, that it allows us to make better decisions and choices individually and collectively than we otherwise would be able to. So yeah, that's where I'm coming from. And our most recent piece of work is about humanoid robots. Humanoid robotics. And so far as that, I've often seen you wear the robots are coming t-shirt, right?
Boom.
So
plug the merch, Adam, do it. Yes, sir. We got to send you like a bunch of shirts too. I'm going to ask for your address after so you can get some of the merch.
So, and robotics is something that I've personally been publishing about for a decade now. And I wrote about it in my book, specifically the implications for the environment, because I'm an environmental scientist by training, and that my passion and personal interest is still drawn to that domain of implications. I mean, these technologies are going to have sweeping implications across every conceivable domain, social, political, and on and on. The environmental ones have a special place in my heart, and I'm particularly excited about what's in the offing for environmental progress, solving environmental problems with these incredible new tools that are good, we're going to have at hand. And so if you asked, I think pretty much, let's say 98 out of 100 environmental activists or environmental scientists, I think you'd get maybe even 99, but let's say 98 out of 100 would not assume that the robots are coming is like the best news you could possibly have for the environment and sustainability. That's like, it's totally unorthodox to think that way. But in my view, as a technology theorist, in addition to, you know, an environmental scientist, I think that's totally obvious. We are going to be able to tackle problems we never even imagined we could get our hands around with these technologies. So yeah, as you can tell, I'm super excited about all of this. I'm very optimistic.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I'm constantly struggling with this sort of revolution that's happening in technology. Is like, it's, you can kind of see if you sort of extrapolate forward long enough, you can kind of see how disruptive and world changing all of this is truly. But the lack of clarity that I'm struggling with is the path. And you kind of, you guys kind of touched this on the Rethink X piece as well. Is like the path to get there seems the most blurry because of how potentially quickly and disruptive all of this is going to be, and how wide impacting it's going to be. I mean, it's gonna impact so many different places of labor value, how people interact with each other in technology. Like it just changes everything, you know. And that's like, the outcome looks obvious. Where we are right now looks obvious. The middle is a mess. I mean, it's a freaking mess, right? And I really want to deep dive that in this conversation. But the one thing I want to start with is the research around electric vehicles from Tony and the team and y'all was one of the primary things that got me really interested in what's happened in electrification. And now what's becoming extremely obvious, which is everything was going electric. And y'all were very accurate in calling that very, very early. Talk to me about the confidence that was behind that research and the confidence behind this research, and help me understand sort of why you guys are as confident as you are about this, and if there are any similarities between the two, maybe just to kind of set the stage before we really deep dive the robot stuff.
Well, absolutely. Sure. I mean, the thing to understand here is that fundamentally, the dynamics are identical. Identical, the same dynamics, the same fundamental forces, fundamental relationships that produce the same patterns of outcomes are evident in robotics, in new food technologies, in transportation with electric vehicles. I'll talk about that in a second. Also with energy and with hundreds of other technologies historically, the same exact dynamics that led to, you know, the disruption of film cameras by digital cameras, or natural agriculturally produced fabric dyes versus synthetic fabric dyes, and hundreds of other examples. It's all the same underlying pattern. And this is what Tony identified and then formalized in a theoretical framework 15 years ago. I mean, he wrote his first book about energy was called Solar Trillions with the T. And that was in 2009, I believe he published that. So this is 15 years ago. Trillions seemed insane then. He was mocked. He was ridiculed. But it was where the dynamics, it was where the numbers were pointing. And so the theoretical frameworks has some weeds in it. I mean, it's got a lot of detail in it. But the two big components of it that are clear to see are, number one, costs fall over time in a consistent and predictable manner for any new technology. And they're driven fundamentally by an experience curve behind them. So in simple terms, the more we make of anything, the better we get at it. And that's for a number of reasons. We learn, but also scale helps. So as the cumulative output, the cumulative production of any technological good grows over time, cost tends to fall. So that stands to reason, right? We make more and more and more of something, and we get better and better and better at making it economically. That's what we call a cost curve. And they are predictable. They're nonlinear, So it's a it follows a power law function. But if you plot it on a logarithmic chart, you can see a perfectly straight line for most technologies. It's clear as day for electric vehicles. It's clear as day for the components in electric vehicles, especially batteries. Now, this was obvious in the data 15 years ago, but it wasn't understood. The understanding needed to see and interpret the data wasn't there. That's become more widespread, thankfully, and thanks perhaps in part to our work. But Tony saw that, Tony Seba saw that 15 years ago. And he published a synthesis between what was happening in electric vehicles with what was happening in clean energy, the same patterns, cost driving those, being driven down inexorably in the case of all the component technologies. He saw that and put that together and what that meant. When you combine clean energy with clean transportation. And he called that clean disruption, and that was his, you know, hugely successful best-selling book in 2014. That's 10 years ago now. That was at a time when electric vehicles were being mocked as either just a go-kart or a golf cart or a silly toy for super rich people, like the Tesla Roadster being the flagship example of that. It wasn't, electric vehicles were not taken seriously then, but the data were clear. The costs were falling. And what happens when any technology reaches the point where the cost makes it competitive with existing offerings? It means you've got a value proposition that's competitive with what existing technologies can offer. Now, the thing with technology disruption is it doesn't stop when they reach parity. The new technologies keep getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and they often perform better. Not always, but often. So take the example of digital cameras. In 1993, 1994, 1995, they were just beginning to close in on film cameras in terms of quality and capability and cost. They weren't as good. They weren't super cheap, but they approached parity at that time. And that's when the first consumer devices became available. That's when the disruption started. But it didn't stop when cost reached parity. Costs kept falling for digital cameras, and they exploded in adoption. And so that's where we get the second piece of the puzzle, which is the adoption S curve. The S is exponential at first. And one of the things that's a little unintuitive is that the new system that's created, so the top of the S curve, when you finally do reach saturation, you often look around and say, hey, this new system that was created by this new technology is way bigger and way more capable with way more possibilities and applications than the old technology could support. And so we take orders of magnitude more photographs now than we ever could have with digital cameras. Okay, so all of those same dynamics hold for electric vehicles. Batteries especially were sort of the limiting factor for decades for the electrification of transport. But in the data, it was clear. Costs were falling. And now we're on the exponential portion of the adoption S-curve of electric vehicles. Now, Tony put a couple of other pieces together there as well. Autonomous driving technology, self-driving technology was another element of that. And that too is part of the pattern. It often isn't just one technology, but a convergence of multiple technologies that come together that make a new overwhelming value proposition possible. So smartphones are an example of that. It wasn't just one technology coming together. It wasn't just smartphones. It wasn't just the digital cameras. It wasn't just the battery technology. It wasn't just the chips and the memory and all of the digital and computing technology. It wasn't any one of those things. It was the convergence of all of that together that made smartphones possible into that, well, the breakout moment for them in 2007 with the first iPhone. So that's what we're seeing in all of these domains. This is true in energy as well. Solar, wind, and batteries, they're doing the same thing. All of them are plummeting in cost. They're exploding up the exponential portion of the adoption S curve. And the results are predictable, disruption. So we're going to see the same thing now with robotics, with humanoid robots. It's all of the same dynamics. The costs are falling, and they will reach a point very soon where they will be at parity and offer a enormously competitive value proposition compared to the other source of labor, humans, right? But they're not going to stop. When they're the same cost, they're going to keep getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and they're going to become overwhelmingly competitive. And then it's just the economic forces and the incentive to economize drive the adoption. I mean, if you can get labor for half and then a quarter, and then a tenth, and then a 20th, and then a hundredth of the cost, you're going to switch, and you're going to switch fast. So we have no reason to expect that the dynamics aren't fundamentally the same for all of these technological transformations, for all of these disruptions. And we're quite advanced now in energy. That's undeniable. We're just, you know, we're the U.S. is over 15% solar and wind electricity generation now in 2024. That sounded like a fairy tale 10 years ago. That we were mocked for even suggesting that that was possible. We're well on our way up that curve for electric vehicles. So it's the same story there. And the people who were able to see that 10 or 15 years ago, I think you know who I'm talking about. Tesla's where they are because they understood disruption. Elon Musk clearly understood disruption. He clearly could see the same data, clearly knew what these patterns were. And if you can see this coming in advance and position and leverage and invest appropriately, then you can be in the pole position for when the exponential growth becomes undeniable to everyone else. And that's where we are now with electric vehicles, certainly. With robotics, it's earlier stage, but in a few years, we'll be in exactly that same place.
There's something you said that's extremely interesting where the by the way, thank you for that incredible rundown there. The thing that I love this nerdy stuff, man. Okay. So there was something you said about electric vehicles. So what was the thing that enabled electric vehicles was battery costs coming down. So, and the battery technology getting up to par. And that was the flourishing for electrification. There's a bunch of articles in the last few months that was saying, oh my God, growth's slowing down. But then you look at the data, you're like, yeah, no, it's still one of these things. It's still exponentially growing. China is going to start dumping EVs everywhere. All the studies from Cox and other people are saying that 80% of consumers in the United States by 2028 are going to consider an EV. So it's like obvious where this is going, right? But it was enabled by the battery. Hans and I were talking about this right before you came on. And sorry for stealing your question, Hans, because I'll let you do all the follow-ups, okay? It seems like what is going to enable the human or robot to really take off, if sort of how Hans is thinking about this, and we assume this is correct, is the revolution in artificial intelligence. It's these LLMs, sort of this thing that you have an artificial intelligence that's taking in data, and then you have an end-to-end neural network approach that then allows the artificial intelligence to decide what to do with that data. So before that, it seemed like a human or robot, even though we had the actuators and the batteries and the materials and everything, the brain was the missing piece. And now it seems like with things like OpenAI, with things like these advanced, like that Go computer and all these different, you know, DeepMind and all these things, that was the enabler for human or robots to start taking off. Is that how y'all view it as well from your end? And Hans, if you want to add any extra color, feel free to do so as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to a first approximation, the limiting factor with robotics has been the software, it's been the brains, it's been the intelligence. And we simply didn't have the AI technology up until very recently, right? So I think that it's totally accurate to say that was the chief limiting factor. I mean, other aspects of robotics are improving now rapidly, very rapidly. And there have been advances. I mean, it really helps to have batteries be at their current level of cost and capability than the batteries we had 20 years ago. Right. I mean, it would have been much more expensive, if not outright impossible, to power a humanoid robot with a small form factor battery for an extended period of time if it weren't for the amazing progress in battery technology we've had, thanks to other applications of it in consumer electronics and now electric vehicles and so forth. As we've seen in other technology disruptions, the convergence of multiple technologies makes these new products possible, but they're often bottlenecked by a single key roadblock, and then none of them are able to advance as a result of that. So we could, you know, in an alternate universe where AI had been cracked 50 years ago, I suspect, probably, we would have then had much more progress alongside that in actuators and motors and batteries and all the rest of it, because there would have been the incentive to do all of that investment, to do all that R&D, to do all of that scaling and learning. I think that this is a pattern that fundamentally holds across all technologies. So the limiting factor is a key thing to identify and understand for technology and disruption, no matter what domain it occurs in. So we could point to other ones. In the case of electric vehicles, I think you could certainly argue that that limiting technology was batteries. The other components have certainly improved as well. The motors are vastly better than they were a generation ago, way better than they were 100 years ago when the first electric cars were created. But nevertheless, I think a strong argument could be made that it was the one technology, the energy storage technology, the batteries, that prevented more R&D from occurring than otherwise might have. So things do get bottlenecked on a single technology. I think that's perfectly fair. The one thing that I wrote about, gosh, almost 10 years ago now, was that I suspected in the early days of the autonomous vehicle race, that when Google first entered, before Waymo existed, and when Tesla was real early in, I suspected that a big part of the initial play from the tech giants wasn't because they wanted to become robotaxi companies, but was because this killer app, this incredible use case, enormously valuable, enormous market use case for self-driving vehicles, robots on wheels, would crack open the door to robotics of all kinds. And so my thesis of going back a decade or almost has been that the same technology that you would need in terms of artificial intelligence to successfully model and navigate a 3D, complex 3D environment with other agents and moving objects and obstacles and so forth in it, that is what a car has to do when it's driving, in downtown Manhattan or the streets of Paris or wherever it happens to be, that same artificial intelligence would be the key to robotics applications of all kinds. And I honestly thought that was the original play from Google when they appeared to be at the forefront and sinking enormous sums of money and other resources into the development of self-driving vehicles. This is going back a decade. And then it didn't surprise me at all, for example, when Tesla announced the Optimus robot. So that, I remember when that dropped and the general view was very confused. People were like, is this an April Fool's joke? Is this one of Elon Musk's funny, quirky senses of humor? Right. But no, I mean, that lined up perfectly with stuff I'd been publishing, which is these two applications, robots on wheels in the form of self-driving vehicles, and then robots in other forms, humanoid being a key one, those come out of the same underlying technology that, far as I'd like you were saying, has been a limiting factor, the intelligence, the AI. And it does feel now that that dam has broken open. And now we're on this explosive trajectory upwards in that capability.
Yeah, I was curious, and maybe you kind of have answered the question just now, but perhaps we could go a little bit deeper into it. What brought you specifically and Tony and the RethinkX team to focus on the humanoid robot opportunity as the next major disruption? Instead of, there are lots of other candidates, I'm sure, that are out there that you could focus on. And, the disruption of intelligence itself in the form of artificial intelligence might make a good candidate as well. So, yeah, what brought you to the humanoid form factor specifically, and why that one and not something else?
When you stop and think about it, it's like, oh, yeah, our entire world's built for the human form. Both the nuances of it and also the general scale. I mean, if you had a robot that was 15 feet tall, it wouldn't fit in most, houses, most buildings, most work areas. If it was only 15 inches tall, it wouldn't be able to reach half the things that are in the environment. So the humanoid form makes good sense. Human beings are demonstrably a pretty good general purpose tool using platform. Compared to other animals, we're pretty darn good as far as just general tool users go. A bipedal form with appendages, opposable thumbs on the end of appendages and a sensor suite up at the top. I mean, your head and with your eyes and your ears, all of that works really, really well. Human beings are good generalists. Dogs can't climb trees and dolphins have a hard time on land and so forth. There are other remarkable capabilities and intelligence notwithstanding. The human form is pretty good. It may not be perfect. I mean, maybe there's a better general form that has some wheels or that maybe looks more like an arthropod, a crab, or a spider or something, but the human form works pretty darn well. So I think that there's a lot to be said for the humanoid robot as a general as a general platform for robotics capability writ large. The world's built for that form. We know it works. We're familiar with it, so it's unintimidating. I mean, I think people probably be a little more intimidated working next to a giant metal crab than they were next to an Optimus robot or a Figure One robot or any of the other prominent examples that we're seeing in development. But that could change in the longer term. Specialized forms are likely to be developed and deployed eventually, and maybe we will find a better generalized form. Ecology and biology are existence proofs of this, right? There's not any one ideal way to be an animal. There are many, many hundreds, thousands, millions of specific niches that require optimized forms to succeed in them. So we know that this is the case, and probably that's coming. But in the near term, I think it makes sense to expect the humanoid form to dominate. And then the other thing that's easy to forget, because we naturally freight in our presumptions, our anthropomorphizing, based on our human form and our human experience. But in the case of robots, because they can learn instantly, they can have skill transfer as easily as a download. The value of generality just gets dialed up to another level. So if you are a general robot and you can learn new skills instantly, like not even overnight, but like over the air, and you can be redeployed literally overnight. You can work in a factory one day and a restaurant the next and even the battlefield on the day after that. That redeployability and reskilling capability that robots, all robots, will have by virtue of their digital intelligence, as opposed to the old fashioned organic intelligence that we have, by not having those constraints, the general purpose form becomes more valuable, right? If you're specialized, you can't redeploy into a new environment because you're not general purpose. So I think that aspect of digital intelligence increases the relative value of a general purpose robot. So putting all of those things together, that's why we were drawn to the humanoid robot as almost certainly the key disruptor of human labor, at least over the next decade or two.
Yeah, I think the very interesting takeaway there is, like, you know, when you think about, you know, you were talking about our form factor being just fantastic for general use case. And then, you know, we all have the same makeup of muscles and joints and everything, but we have differing levels of strength. We have different levels of dexterity. We have different levels of patience and laziness, you know? So it's like that's why we have that saying, like, you know, jack of all trades, master of none, you know, like some people are very focused. But to me, it's like what you just talked about, it's jack of all trades, master of all, right? That's the kind of vibe that this humanoid robot brings with it. And I think that's what might be difficult to conceptualize because we don't have that right now where we have a humanoid robot that can do all those things yet. But the path, like, you know, we've talked about here, the path seems clear that eventually, with the combination of costs coming down and manufacturing capabilities becoming better, which will bring the cost down, and the development of artificial intelligence, which will give the robot the brain that for it to do whatever it needs to do, then as long as the tasks aren't above the limit of the robot's physical capabilities, in theory, the brain should be able to do everything. So it's like literally short of the actuators not being able to be strong enough. If you download it in the brain, given that the AI will be able to just do whatever it needs to do the thing that you want it to do and learn however it needs to learn, everything breaks, right? Over time, it feels like everything breaks. And I say breaks, meaning like the way we think about labor, like you guys have written, the way we think about what an economy is and so on and so forth. Elon Musk has talked about it in the past. So walk me through how do you see each industry being disrupted in the next 10 to 15 years? Like, where does it start? How does it evolve? How many humanoid robots are we going to have? Because it's, if you know, if you, the one thing you wrote on the piece, the team wrote on the piece, was that we're going to move away from a job, from jobs to tasks. And that's kind of what you talked about too, is like, you could be, you know, folding laundry and then you're freaking trying to find mines on the on the battlefield, right? Like, I don't know a lot of people that are willing to do that kind of, you know, like, you know, that kind of a gig economy type stuff, right? So just kind of walk me through that a little bit, like maybe give us a little bit more of a solid, like, how does the next few years look like from an industry disruption perspective? And then I'm sure this will turn into a crazy discussion here in a second. If it hasn't already.
I mean, the getting from here to there, right? That is the challenge. And the truth is that nobody knows. There's no crystal ball. There's no way to perfectly predict exactly what's going to happen over the next 10 to 15 years. The key is to have principles in place that guide you so number one, you know, massive change is coming. Number two, you have principles guiding your response in anticipation of that change. We have to have principles that work, like be open-minded, be willing to experiment, don't fear failure. Nobody knows exactly how to get this right. We know it's a huge, big deal for human civilization at every level, but nobody knows how this is going to work out in the details. We've got to figure that out. And anybody could be a winner. It's anybody's race to win right now. It's anybody's game right now. And so the you need to be guided by principles like experiment, learn by looking around you, learn from your own failures, and don't be afraid to fail, and so on. Those are the sorts of things that we need to be positioning ourselves with. It's we've learned the hard way how difficult it is to predict the impacts, the total implications of a new technology, right? Even if you can see some of the details, it's often hard to picture the granularity and all of the interactions there. And it's often difficult to see the downsides or the upsides, depending on your attitude, depending on your orientation. It's easy to focus on all the good things that could happen or all of the bad things that could happen, and not on the nuance in between and how, like you said, we get from here to there. So I don't have answers. I think the best thing that we can do is ask the right questions. That's what we need to be doing at this early stage in the disruption. Ask the right questions and have a posture of open-mindedness and learning, and also a sense of urgency here. Like, you can't pretend this isn't coming. You can't pretend it's not going to happen. You can't pretend the status quo is just going to continue. That's not on the cards. But I would caution against believing anybody who says, oh, I got this whole thing figured out. Nobody knows. But there are a few features of past disruptions and examples that we've seen historically that we can learn lessons from, that can inform us about what to expect this time through. Okay, so one of those lessons that you mentioned that we talk about in the piece that we wrote not long ago about this is that new technologies and disruption, because they change the game, they change the metrics, right? They change how you have to measure performance, how you have to measure what it is that you're observing so that you can manage and organize around it, so that you can govern it, for example. So in this case, what we suspect, because it's the sort of thing we've seen with technologies in the past, is that the unit of analysis is going to change. And in the case of robotics, it's going to change from jobs, which is sort of the familiar unit of labor that all of us live and breathe up until recently in human history. I mean, the last century or so, it's been structured in quite a consistent way. There's a social contract. For many of us, especially those who aren't fortunate enough to own a very large amount of rent producing capital, we have to exchange our labor for some claim to society's productivity. So when you collect a salary, when you collect a wage, when you get paid for in a transaction, hopefully it's a voluntary transaction. Took us a long time as humanity to figure that out too, to our everlasting shame. And it's not irrelevant for robotics and artificial intelligence. The abomination of slavery persisted for far, far, far too long, right? But again, like in the last century, the prevailing social contract has been one of mutual exchange. I agree to sell my labor to you on some sort of basis, some sort of contractual basis. And in exchange for that sale, I receive money. I receive typically the currency of my country. This is how it's been structured typically. That may change going forward. And with that money, I can then go out and make a claim against all of society's other productivity. If I want something that's produced in a factory over there, I can go claim it with my money. If I like something that's over in a restaurant over there, I can go make a claim against that. And this is the contract. This is the system that we have for most of us, those of us who aren't fortunate enough to be rich, basically. And for that money, that claim against society's productivity to come from rents from capital. Okay. That's familiar to everybody. I'm explaining it in kind of an esoteric and maybe academic way, but that's the picture, right? But robots aren't going to have those sorts of arrangements. They're not going to enter, at least not until certainly not until they're sentient. Now, that's a separate question. We can set that aside. But for right now, humanoid robots that are narrowly artificially intelligent, they aren't going to have labor contracts the way that a person does. They're not going to enter into a transaction to sell their labor, right? They are capital. And so they are going to be deployed in the way that other machinery, other equipment is. And so we have to think very differently about how they're going to perform and what metrics we need to use to observe the labor, to observe the work that they get done, and to understand it, to analyze it, to measure it, and then to govern it, right? And so that's why we need a different unit of analysis. And it seems that the clearest unit of analysis for useful labor is a task. Now, when we human beings work a job, we do many different tasks. I mean, a typical job involves doing dozens or hundreds or thousands of tasks and can even be open-ended. You can get, as part of your responsibility for a job, many jobs involve the responsibility of doing a task if it needs to get done, even if it's not one you've ever been trained to do, or that a task that's never existed before. It's just your responsibility to figure out what tasks you need to do. That can be part of a job. With robots, humanoid robots, that's not going to be the case. Tasks is the unit of analysis. That's the metric that we need to be focused on. So that's how one way in which it's going to be really quite different. And we've seen that in the past, right? I mean, I use the example of digital cameras. The frame, the film frame of photography was the way you measured film and capturing images and photographs and even moving pictures, right? There was film motion pictures were just 24 still frames a second. For more than a century. But then that stopped being the meaningful metric for photography when digital technology disrupted imaging. And then we needed a new metric. We needed completely different ways of measuring things. Okay, it's going to be something very similar to that. The second thing that, well, the next thing to say about what's coming and how it relates to jobs is that we suspect, I mean, our analysis suggests, and again, we're not the final word on all of this, but based on our analysis and our understanding of disruption, what we expect is that this new technology will be deployed in a way that meets, at least initially, that meets latent demand first. So here's the way to think about it. There is an enormous amount of work, amount of labor, that doesn't get done by human beings at all. And it's not because that labor wouldn't be valuable, wouldn't be useful. It's not something that we collectively would wish to get done, or even we individually would like, I'll look around my house and there's all sorts of work I wish would get done. I wish my kids would help me do more of it, but it doesn't get done because it doesn't, it for one reason or another, it doesn't map to the transactional basis of that we currently have for employment that produces labor that gets those tasks completed. That doesn't happen. So there's an enormous amount of latent demand that exists out in the world that isn't currently being fulfilled by human beings, but that could be, and we think will be fulfilled, especially at the beginning, by humanoid robots. And so this is true for jobs that are too dull or dangerous for any human being to voluntarily enter into a contract to perform. It wouldn't pay enough and it would be too risky and so forth. So in the first few years, at the beginning of the disruption, one thing to watch for is that pattern, that the robots are going to roll out, they're going to be deployed, and they won't be all that capable as well. Their capabilities, the lowest it's ever going to be now, and it will grow spectacularly. But right now, it will be simple jobs that would be too low paying or perhaps too repetitive or dangerous for human beings to enter into a job to provide today. And that's going to, there's there's a risk there. There's a risk. There's the risk of us becoming complacent, for us being, you know, lulled into a false sense of security here, because we could get 5 years and millions of bots into this disruption, and we could look around and say, hey, you know what? They aren't taking anybody's job. This is great. Maybe they're just a force multiplier for civilization. Maybe it's like what the CEOs of the tech companies are saying, that this, the AI is only going to empower you to be a better and more productive worker, more productive in your job. It's not going to take your job. It's just going to 10X you in your job. Well, that may be true for a few years at the beginning when the robots are meeting all of this latent, currently unmet demand. But eventually, tasks are tasks. And as the robots become more and more capable, they are going to disrupt human labor. And we can't pretend like that's not going to exist. So we have a, I think we have an interim, a short-term period here where there isn't going to be technological unemployment catastrophically right from the start, but that doesn't mean it isn't a massive challenge that is coming. And the silver lining on that is that that may give us a grace period. It may give us an opportunity to do more planning, to do more anticipation, to set our affairs in order better, so that we can react well, so that we are ready when the unemployment does begin to occur. And I call that, we call that a soft landing. We have an opportunity here to get ready for, to create a soft landing for the disruption of labor. So that's what we see so far in the from here to there. There's a lot more that we need to do, a lot more learning that we need to get done, but that's what we see so far.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that scares the shit out of me, right? Because it's, because you're going to have a situation, because one of the primary limiting factors of the human or robot is that AI brain that is now being solved. And as long as there are human or robots out there, like if we use Tesla as an example, for this example, if Tesla gets by 2030, they're able to make just optimistically a million bots or whatever, or pessimistically, who knows what the number will be. But let's say they make a million bots by 2030 and there's a million bots out there by 2035, you know, because they're getting exponentially better at manufacturing, costs are coming down from our materials, the supply chain is opening up, there's a lot more demand. They get to 10 million, 20 million robots, right? And the form factor and the joints, the actuators, everything, they're optimized for the end state, meaning that they're not thinking about what jobs can it do with the capability it has now, but what jobs can it do that every human can do on planet Earth, right? So the only limiting factor then becomes to enable the robot to go from narrow to truly vast use cases is a software update. We've talked about this, right? So it's not like you're going to go from 10 million robots or 20 million robots, and then in 2035, you start making new robots with new capabilities. No, it's the current fleet of robots that are out there, then suddenly, like you've talked about before, suddenly have all these new abilities that they never had before that start transitioning away from what we don't want to do to what we're doing. And because the cost makeup of a human or robot if you amortize it over the 10 years or whatever, is so much cheaper than human labor. There's a forcing function to adopt that technology versus a human, and it's not like companies start making them right away; they're already there. So it's kind of like, this is like a super crude example, but the whole immigration crisis we have right now in the United States, let's say, it's like all of a sudden there's like all this extra labor that shows up that is looking for work. And then everybody's like, oh, yeah, no, why aren't we hiring these people? Like, of course we should hire these people. I feel like the same exact thing is going to happen with human or robots, right? So it's like, and I don't feel like that's well understood at all. I don't think that's well understood at all. You use the Tesla cars as an example for the last, and I hate to be using Tesla here as an example. It's just the best one I have in mind here. But the cars that are in the fleet right now went from having the necessary hardware to drive themselves in 2017 to now actually driving themselves in 2024. And it wasn't like Tesla had to make new cars that can drive themselves. They can just drive themselves, right? So we already have like proof that this approach works. you know? And so you just start doing that with a human or robot. So, yeah, I mean, and I think it's important to highlight this again, because like you said, it's this is the transformation. This is the thing that's going to fundamentally change what it means to interface with a human or robot. And the thing that I have stuck in my head is like, okay, so do we then, does labor become so cheap at that point that we all have access to labor then? Like, what does it mean to have a job? Does the government own a fleet of a billion robots long-term that we all have access to, and then we no longer transact with money, we transact with, like, what happens? What happens?
Well, the truth is nobody knows. And there may be more than one system, more than one organizing system that would work, in the same way that there's more than one type of government for human affairs, right? So we need to be open-minded about this, and we do need to explore this. It needs research. So my team is going to be working on trying to get better answers, and that will come from modeling. But the truth is that there's, you know, that this is something that where real world pilot examples are going to be necessary in order to get a handle on this. And we cannot do it soon enough. We cannot begin doing this experimenting and learning soon enough. And if I absolutely have to ask to emphasize that. The one thing that I also want to emphasize, and it's easy, it's so easy to miss this point, and that is that jobs disrupted by robots doesn't mean nothing gets done, right? So the idea that, well, a human being could lose your job eventually to a machine, okay? When that's happened in the past, it hasn't happened in this same way. Mechanization is very different than automation. Mechanization has been phenomenally successful. It has made humanity vastly more productive. Example I use is bulldozers. A bulldozer can move more earth in an hour than 100 people with shovels can move in a month. But a bulldozer still has to be piloted by somebody if it's not autonomous. It still has to be operated with the intelligence from a human being. And so you have this you have a job bulldozer driver, but you lost a lot of historically, these older jobs, the earth moving and earth working jobs that only human beings and only muscle power could do prior to the advent of machinery, of combustion engines and electric motors in the late 19th century that made mechanization possible. Now, this time it's not just more of that, it is fundamentally different, because eventually there will be no task that a human being can do that a machine can't do much, much better and much, much cheaper. Now, the thing that gets forgotten within that difference is all of the tasks still get done, and more of them, and they get done better. What that means is that all of the value, all of the production, all of the value still gets created. Useful goods and services still get produced in an economy where machines do all of the quote unquote work. Right? That's very easy to forget. So it becomes a question of how do we distribute the fruits of that machine labor? Today, we have a social contract. We talked about that a minute ago, that helps make that arrangement. It's mediated through the purchasing power. It's mediated through this mechanism of being able to make a claim against all of your society's production, all of its goods and services. It's mediated through money. But where do you get money today? Well, you have to work a job for it if you don't own a bunch of capital that produces rent for you. In the future, we're going to have a different arrangement that gives us that claim against the productivity. But the productivity will still be there. In fact, almost certainly there will be orders of magnitude more production. There'll be more value created. There'll be more and better goods and services. That's what's wonderful about this. That's the utopian side of it. That's the age-old dream of cornucopia that dates, you know, before recorded human history. Certainly, there have been myths and legends and dreams of that sort of state for humanity. But we're going to have to figure out a very different way for individuals to have some claim against that. The production that their society outputs, other than, well, my claim comes from me working, putting in the hours and the blood and the sweat and the tears to get a few bucks in my hand with which I can go out and make my choices to purchase what's on offer. We're going to have to figure out a different way to do that. There are proposals. We don't at RethinkX don't have an official position on any of this at this time. Proposals like universal basic income, proposals like universal basic services, and so forth. There are proposals. But the truth is, nobody knows yet, and we have to get this figured out, and we've got to get it figured out fast, because this isn't 50 or 100 years away, or 500 years away. It's not science fiction. It's imminent. It's imminent. This is not the domain of armchair philosophizing or a late dorm room debate, right? This is not fanciful. This is going to be as real as a heart attack within 20 years. And so we can't start soon enough in figuring this stuff out.
Yeah. And so, okay. So just to conceptualize this for the audience, maybe so that we can sort of drive home the point as to why this is inevitable, because the forcing function is too strong as it pertains to how much cheaper human or robot automated labor is versus a human being. So do you have maybe a number in mind? Like, let's say if we fast forward 10 to 15 years, if we follow the cost curve down, is there sort of a number you can throw out that says, okay, so let's say human doing, housekeeping or whatever, lawn work. Let's say the standard unit is $10 an hour for a human to do physical labor globally. I don't even know if that's the right number. Let's just say $10 an hour. What's the equivalent cost per hour for a human or robot if you go down 10 years, 15 years? Like, what is that number, the equivalent?
Yeah, it's difficult to say, but I think, I mean, just some very simple calculations show that humanoid robots are going to enter the market at $10 an hour, thereabouts. That's fairly easy to show, right? So, and even if they're very expensive, relatively speaking. So
they start at $10 an hour.
They'll start at $10 an hour. So the calculation we run through as an example, just for illustration purposes in the piece we published, is $200,000 per bot. So imagine that's their initial cost. But they're going to work 20,000 hours of labor in their useful lifetime before you decommission them. That's reasonable to expect. 20,000 hours of work out of this thing. It's like mileage on a car. That's what you can expect. So what is that? Well, $200,000 divided by 20,000 hours, that's $10 an hour. And you can figure that's the total cost. So that's the CapEx plus whatever it costs to operate and maintain it, keep it running while it's going. And keep in mind, while all of this is happening, the cost of operating is going to fall as well. I mean, the main cost is going to be electricity as an input. If there's a software licensing fee, that's another thing to think about, but who knows how smart these things will get with open source software that's just free, right? So the cost to operate these things is going to be minimal for all practical purposes. It's an electric machine, and electricity is going to become very, very inexpensive with the energy disruption that my team has been publishing about and Tony Seba has been publishing about. And that Tesla, for example, has known about and has been leading in for 15 years. So all of that is going to come to fruition at the same time this is happening. So the even at the very high initial cost of $200,000, you're already competitive with human labor, and it stands to reason. I mean, how much does a human being earn over a number of years, 3, 4, 5 years. It's in the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on where in the global labor market you are, right? But that's a pretty high entry point. I mean, that's a generous assumption about how expensive these machines are going to be. Unitree, the robotics company, just announced a robot that looks surprisingly capable for under $20,000, less than a tenth of that. That's under a dollar an hour, right? So, and that's today with initial offerings looking like they're going to be that competitive. Now, it's not just cost, it's also capability, right? So it may be quite a while before a robot can succeed in out-competing on a task-by-task-by-task basis. Say, for example, take the examples you used in domestic or landscaping applications, for example. If you were to deploy a robot right now, it would not be very good at folding your laundry, and it wouldn't be very good at mowing yards, and it wouldn't be very good at any number of other tasks. But that is going to change quickly, right? So where are we in 5 years? Where are we in 10 years with that capability? My money is that these machines are going to be very capable, perhaps not at the level of a human being, but certainly capable enough that they're worth a dollar an hour in many of the world's labor markets, right? So think North America, Europe, and large parts of the rest of the world, a machine that operated for a dollar an hour would be able to do a lot of useful work for you. And I suspect, we suspect as RethinkX as a team, that the demand is going to be absolutely enormous for these machines. Absolutely enormous. It will be it will be impossible to for supply to meet demand in for a very long time. It'll be demand will outstrip supply for the foreseeable future. Let's just say that. And that's at you know, at costs 5 or 10 years from now, down at the dollar an hour level. Then what happens if you get out 15 or 20 years, things really start breaking down. I mean, at some point it stops making sense even trying to use dollars to measure these things. 15 years, 20 years from now, a dollar isn't going to mean what it means today because of this disruption. So we get into the point where there's so much feedback, so much recursion in the cause and the effect here that it's extremely difficult to make predictions. So that's its own challenge, its own separate challenge. But certainly on the 5 to 10 year time horizon, I would imagine the dollar an hour benchmark is one to keep in mind. Certainly not unrealistic, or certainly not impossible, certainly not implausible. And that dollar will buy you lots and lots of useful work, lots of capability. And the capability will only grow over time. As you were saying, Farzad, it's just a download away, right? The hardware will be able to function perfectly well. It will be the difference between a humanoid robot that can and can't fold a shirt is software, right? It's not going to be it needs a new pair of hands or a new set of eyes or something like that. That's not going to be the limiting factor. And at a dollar an hour, I would imagine a lot of people would find lots of uses for these things.
And I think so. And to drive home that point, right? So like the one thing that I'm glad you brought up folding clothes, because that is literally, Adam, the worst thing. I'm going to curse. I fucking
nobody likes
hate,
folding laundry.
I fucking nobody hate likes. It, Adam. I'm not even going to bleep this out, okay?
And he doesn't even have kids yet.
And I don't even have kids yet. Just I have wait, one coming in a week.
Just wait.
Yeah.
Oh, you so, say that now.
I know. Oh man. But let's go through the math, right? So it's like, okay, so I could hire somebody that, you know, helps me with housekeeping stuff. And, you know, we have people that come every couple of weeks to clean the house and stuff. But then if I'm going to add the layers of like folding clothes and doing all these chores, it's like, okay, but then, you know, then the bills start to stack up and I'm like, well, I'll just do it myself. Cause number one, it's good for my mental health. I can get away from what I'm doing and just kind of fold clothes for like half an hour to an hour. I disconnect, all that good stuff, right? So instead of paying somebody, even my dog hates it, you can hear him. So I can do that. But then the equation you're talking about, okay, but if I can have a robot in my house that costs a dollar an hour, and so let's say it costs that, takes that robot, I don't know, 5 hours to fold the same number of clothes that it takes me to do in half an hour, I don't care. I'm not doing it. The robot's doing it.
And it could be standing down there at 2 a.m. doing it.
Exactly.
When you're not there, right? So, and another thing to think about is when labor is that inexpensive, why do you only have one robot? Why don't you have five?
Exactly. Exactly. And that same robot that's folding the clothes, right, can then can walk around the house and do surveillance. It can also clean the floors. It can also help me move stuff around the house. Like that's a general purpose, right? It's like it becomes this compounding effect of like, you know, that moving away from jobs to tasks. That's exactly what we're talking about here. When you have something in your house that costs a dollar an hour, regardless of what it does, when we live in an economy where depending on the job, you have differing levels of costs because of the complexity, the supply and demand dynamics, you know, all that other stuff that's dictating how much that labor costs. If it's physical, it's a dollar an hour. That's it. You're done. Right? So it's like, exactly. Like, why wouldn't I have 1,000 of them in my house? You know?
Right. And it won't be a dollar. I mean, that's a moving target. It'll be, you know, 2 years, 3 years after that, it'll be 50 cents an hour. And then 5 years after that, it'll be 10 cents an hour. And where does this head? The marginal cost of labor is approaching zero in this scenario. So I think we can look to some existence proofs from human history to end some lessons, because there, some of these are cautionary tales as well, to say, well, what happens when a person or a family has an open-ended, not infinite, but an unconstrained availability of labor at their beck and call, at their disposal? We can look to history for that. There have been human beings, there have been families, landed gentry, aristocracy, royalty, that have had, they've been in an approximately similar situation. They've been surrounded by servants. They've been able to enjoy the benefits of being catered to in that sense. And like I said, some of that can be a cautionary tale. If we look at examples of that, it doesn't all speak well to human character, right? But there are examples, wonderful examples, where people with good character availed themselves of that prosperity and that privilege, and found wonderful things to do with their time because they didn't have to engage in toil and drudgery. Now, that was again, that was an ugly situation because it was a zero-sum game between human beings in the past. But the way to think about it going forward is that in the same way that we can do different things because we have laundry machines and we don't have to spend 3 hours a day physically laundering clothing with soap and water with our hands in a bucket, that time saving has freed us up to do other things. And so in that sense, many of us, fortunate enough to live in the prosperous countries of the world today, already have a taste of what wealth was in centuries past. And what humanoid robotics perhaps offer is more of that going forward. The question is, can we adapt to it in a way that is ethical, equitable, humane, that we don't lose ourselves and what makes us human in the process, right? These are big challenges, but it's not like there's nothing to learn from history in seeing this. It's not like there's no way we can understand any of the implications here. I think we can anticipate, we can try to look to history for examples that can inform us. And then of course, there's a great deal of experimentation that has to happen. We can run pilot projects. We can deploy robots in localized experiments and find out what really happens when somebody has a machine like this at their beck and call 24 hours a day. What does that do to a neighborhood? What does that do to a city? We need to find these things out. And my hope is that, I mean, it's prosperity, it's abundance, it's going to be on balance wonderful. But it doesn't mean there aren't going to be downsides and dark sides and temptations and ways to fall, both as individuals and then collectively as a result of this technology. So caution's warranted. And we just saw this with the internet and the digital revolution. It's true. The internet's marvelous. The free communication. Sure, look at what we're doing here for next to nothing. It's unbelievable 100%. What's possible, right? But that doesn't mean there's no downside, right? I mean, social media has its dark sides. It is damaging. It is, it's taking its toll on some of us, and it has to be dealt with appropriately. We need to be prepared for the same sorts of dynamics with human robotics. Probably it will be overwhelmingly a positive thing for humanity, but we can probably imagine some negative aspects of it as well. And those are the sorts of things we're going to have to plan for.
That's the sort of hopeful message that kind of keeps me from going down the dark path, like the dark rabbit hole of this thing, because it does seem like humans are exceedingly good at making new things that are just, so if we go back 100 years, right, like the example you use, and we imagine, like, we're like, hey, this is what the world looks like in 2024, in 2014, and not 1914, right? Would all be like in 1914. No way. This is a science fiction cuckoo guy that's writing a stupid story, and there's no way you should believe him. But then somehow the same exact brain and body that lived in 1914, it's kind of like, oh yeah, no, it's normal. I have a supercomputer in my pocket and I'm able to make a living sitting in my office doing YouTube videos and talking to incredible people like Adam and Hans. And I'm just chilling here, and I can have a kid. I'm married. I have a stable relationship. I have friends. I have the safety of my home. There's not a lion chasing me down. So it's like, I feel like we're figuring out ways to like I feel like that's the human spirit, is like, we know how to make the new normal, right? And it's that's my hope with this thing. The scary part is the suddenness of the change, you know, could especially if it impacts people negatively very quickly. If this technology, let's say, ends up being a net disruptor of jobs, taking away means of generating income so that they can afford to, you know, pay a dollar an hour. There might be a situation where people lose their work and they can't even get a robot for a dollar an hour because they don't have enough money to pay food because the job they had was displaced by the same robot. And we don't have the right, let's say, safety nets or things in place as a society to help that transition. And then all of a sudden you have 5 million people or 10 million people in a country or 20 million people that start a civil war. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like that's the kind of dynamic that could very well happen. And like, you know, if we don't have the right net in place. But again, like, I feel like even in the darkest moments of humanity, we figured out how to get past it. But like, the thing is, like, do we have to go through the darkness? Do we have to go through that darkness? Like, is that darkness inevitable for us to get on the flip side? And that's the one I struggle with, because I really love the promise of the technology. You know, like, this statement on the shirt is very like, it's just an objective statement that says they're coming. I'm not saying it's good or bad. They're just coming. I don't freaking know. You know what I'm saying? Nobody knows. Like you said, nobody knows. But it's like that's the thing that I struggle with, is like, is that dark period inevitable to traverse through? And I'm gonna throw it to Hans here. Sorry, dude. I'm like hogging up Adam. My bad, bro.
I was just gonna make another point about the fact that we can't not do anything either. Like, yes, the robots are coming, that's inevitable, but you know, there's lots of other challenges that are going to eat our lunch if we don't solve them as well. And so it's kind of like a no-win situation as far as the fact that we just have to take risks. Like, part of existing in the universe as we know it involves experiencing risk, and there's risks in staying where we are, doing things the way that we're doing things, and then there's risks in changing the way that we're doing everything as we move forward. And people are always afraid of the unknown. But unfortunately, we know that we can't stay here, and so we have to do something. And so that's kind of another point just to think about as we try to motivate ourselves, as Adam is saying, to really think about, okay, as we build forward and we can, you know, we can see that the data is clear, these things are coming, there's some pretty easy to understand and predict trends that those are going to bring into the world. How do we handle all of that? So that's, yeah, I like, that's one of the reasons why we end up talking about this topic so much, is because we want to understand what the future looks like. And we're hoping that, you know, both for ourselves and for our children and our children's children, that the world is a better place, not a worse place. And all of these things, you know, are the main things to focus on that are going to shape what that future looks like.
Well, I agree with all of this. And one of the things that gives me solace, that gives me consolation as I think through this, is prosperity has always been a trump card of sorts, right? With enough prosperity, other problems don't just get solved. They often dissolve. They often just fade away. They cease to be problems in the same sort of way. When you're not prosperous, one of the most difficult challenges, moment to moment, hour to hour, day by day, is all the trade-offs you have to make. You have to choose between things because you don't have the means. You don't have enough prosperity. If you don't have enough prosperity, you can't solve all of your problems. It's like if your house is on fire and the pipes are broken and it's flooding and, you know, if you've got 10 problems you have to deal with and you don't have enough prosperity, you have to pick and choose between them. And that is agonizing. That is exhausting. That is a difficult situation to be in. And that is the human condition up until very recently in human history, right? You were just damned if you do and damned if you don't, because there wasn't enough prosperity to solve everything. Now, as humanity has become more prosperous, many fundamental problems have just disappeared. That were once absolutely calamitous. It were just atrocious what we lived through. A great example that I like to point to is just the marvel of clean, safe, potable drinking water and sanitation. You know, it's so easy to take those for granted. We only notice the water in our lives when it for whatever reason, in some extraordinary circumstances, it stops being available. Right?
If it snows in Texas.
Right. I mean, we just take it for granted. But that's an example where we have abundance. We have a level of prosperity that enables us to solve problems with such ease that we can even forget they even exist. Right? Now, that's what we want in principle, in my mind. And this technology in particular, but especially with the other three major disruptions of energy and transportation and food, when you put all of four of these disruptions together, that constellation spells superabundance. It spells an absolutely staggering level of prosperity born of productivity. Okay, and that doesn't mean paving over the entire planet in the process. I mean, one of the things that you can do if you have enough prosperity and enough productivity, you have huge, huge crews of robots, is have them clean up the natural environment. That's fantastic. It's a big part of my discussion in my book, is all of the good that you can do to safeguard ecological integrity if you have prosperity. It doesn't mean that we're stuck with this miserable trade-off where you can only have prosperity at the expense of the rest of the natural world or whatever. With enough prosperity, you can have it all. And that's unequivocal. That's unequivocal. It's demonstrably true. And we've seen that in many different domains, in a narrower sense, in many different specific domains. Now, what does that mean what's the upshot here? Well, what I think it means is that the only sensible play at this point is to go all in on robotics. I think that's the only sensible play here, because they promise so much prosperity. And the reason why is, and Elon Musk has talked about this, many others have talked about this, if you can manufacture labor, then you can manufacture economic growth. You can manufacture prosperity. We've never been able to do that in the past. Earlier in the conversation, we talked about limiting factors. The battery was the limiting factor in electric vehicles. The intelligence, the AI, was the limiting factor in robotics. There's often a limiting factor. Labor has been the ultimate limiting factor for humanity. It's been the ultimate limiting factor. You could only have as much productivity as you could have people able to engage in labor, because labor gets injected into the production process somewhere along the supply chain of every good and service. Every single one, virtually without exception, has some input of labor into it. And that means you're fundamentally bottlenecked by how much labor you've got available. And that means how many skilled working adults you've got that are able to do it. Right? And then how do you grow labor? Well, there's only two ways. There's the old fashioned way, which is reproduction, grow your population. And then there's immigration, but immigration is a zero sum game. I mean, if people are coming into one country, it means they're emigrating, they're leaving another country. And we don't want zero sum games here. So this new technology, humanoid robots, it fundamentally changes the rules of the game in a way we've never seen before, where you could actually manufacture, you can build labor itself. That it blows up. It's like a chain reaction. It's like a nuclear explosion. It blows open the doors of the potential for productivity and prosperity in a way we've never seen before. And one of the things that we discuss in our piece, and one thing I think I believe very strongly, is that that simple core logic means it's time for societies to go all in on investing in this technology, because the fruits of that are going to be so absolutely staggering. And countries compete economically already, right? Different nations, they compete economically. And we get excited by like 1% more GDP growth this year than last year. That's a big deal. Politicians celebrate that. Policymakers celebrate a little bit more GDP growth. So then tell me what happens when over a 15 to 20 year period, you 10x or 20x the size of your economy, right? What is that worth investing in today? If you're a policymaker, and pick a country, throw a dart at the world map and pick a country. You're a policymaker in that country. What is it worth to you to 10x the size of your economy, the prosperity in your society? What is that worth? That's why we go all in on this technology.
I love that so much. That's such a hopeful and like that. That's how I want everybody to think about this, so that we can all get there. right? It's like, that's the one thing you said that really started getting my gears turning was, over time, prosperity has been the great differentiator. It's been the dissolver. Like, if you're prosperous, just if you're happy because you're prosperous, like, prosperity and happiness, I feel like, go hand in hand very closely, or like satisfaction, or prosperity is the greatest force against war and violence and death and
slavery. Absolutely. Prosperous people have too much to lose. They don't fight. Prosperous people cooperate.
Right? Exactly. And I think, and so where my head goes to is, like, even right now in Western nations, if I use the United States as an example, you know, we've as a society, we've done a tremendous amount, but there's still a subset of the United States population that's a lot less lucky than, let's say, the three of us here are. They live paycheck to paycheck. They have a bunch of children. They can barely afford food on the table. They're in debt. They have bills everywhere. They can't even afford a car. They can't afford gas. They can barely pay for electricity. It stresses all over, you know, family drama, friend drama, work drama, lose your job. You got to move your job. You get laid off. The recession crushes you, right? There's all this insane, and I can speak about this because I lived through it, right? It's like one of those things is like, it sucks. It's painful. And I know a lot of people live through that, right? So it's like something like this that can just redefine what prosperity means to people and really democratize prosperity is such a huge force for good. The thing that we and we've talked about this multiple times, but it's worth repeating, is like ensuring that prosperity is democratized so that everyone has access to that prosperity, so that everybody feels that prosperity, is the single biggest piece of this puzzle. It's the prosperity is coming. How do we make sure that everybody has it? Because as humans, we all have a right to that prosperity. Because if the means of manufacturing, if we can all just manufacture prosperity, and over time that same prosperity that manufacturer can manufacture itself, and we're almost like taken out of the loop, right? Because if we make machines that are good at building stuff, they can probably build themselves. And the more they can build themselves, the more they can build themselves, right? So it's like, okay, so how do we all benefit from that, right? And that's like that's the piece. And Andrew Yang talked about this during his campaign. I remember when he was running for president, that was one of the things I was like, oh, that seems like an interesting candidate, right? But like that was the beginning of that sort of like hopefulness, because it's like, okay, there's a path here. It's just, but it requires all of us to get together and decide that that's what we should, you know, that should be the future. It's just like, how do we get there?
Well, I mean, this is an old, longstanding philosophical and ethical question. It's a longstanding debate about what level of disparity is acceptable socially within any unit of analysis you choose, within a family, within a community, within a city, within a nation, internationally, across the planet. What level of difference, what level of disparity as far as material well-being, material abundance, material prosperity, how much of a gap between haves and have-nots is acceptable? Is any gap acceptable? That's open for debate. That's not a settled debate. People have argued very strongly on both sides of that absolute equality should be the what we strive towards, and anything less is a moral failure. And there are strong arguments that some amount of disparity is appropriate, can be useful in the long run, and so forth. There's more than one way to think about this. What I think is unequivocal, what I think most of us could agree on, is that we have to raise the floor, right? We have to raise the floor. We can't let people fall by the wayside. We can't let people fall so far down that they can't get back up, that they're suffering, that with so much prosperity around, even today, that we've already achieved, when we look and see people suffering, when we look around the world and we see hungry children and unhoused people, these things are not acceptable even today with the amount of prosperity we have today. We need to raise the floor. It doesn't mean that you have to cut everybody down to size necessarily. That's an age-old debate. Should you squash everybody to a uniform level? Maybe, maybe not. I would never presume to enter into that debate. I'm no expert in that territory at all. that's outside my pay grade philosophically. But what I think is clear, and what I think most of us could agree on, is that we shouldn't be leaving anybody behind. Not even today with the amount of prosperity we have. We need to get people, we need to pick people up and get them to, we need to raise the floor of prosperity. Now, the great news about these new technologies, about all four of the disruptions, is that they can let us do that in such a spectacular way that it's hard to even put into words. The floor can rise so high that every single person on Earth could be balling like they've got a millionaire's lifestyle 20 years from now. Okay, we can raise the floor like that. But the only way we can do that, the only way, is with technology. There's no way to get there the way many of my fellow environmental activists and environmentalists, environmental scholars think, which is to downsize and shrink the global economy and sacrifice the prosperity that we've achieved up to date. That's, in my mind, that's bonkers. That's so backwards. It's so wrongheaded. The only way we can raise the floor and get everybody lifted into prosperity, some acceptable level of prosperity, is with these new technologies. But the fantastic thing is it's not going to take 100 or 1,000 years for us to do that. It's not going to be the 24th century like Star Trek before we have that kind of prosperity. It's around the corner. It's around the corner. It's 20 years. It's within reach now. And so, yes, we've got a lot of work, a huge amount of work to do to get from here to there. And we got to keep our eye on that prize. And then the question is, you know, what should the gap be ultimately? Well, that's an open-ended question. And again, like I said, beyond my pay grade. But what I think everybody should be able to agree on is that massively more prosperity that lifts the least advantaged, the most disadvantaged, the poorest among us, and I mean in our societies, the privileged, wealthy societies and communities that we, the three of us, and many watching already enjoy, and then around the world as well, in the world's poorer countries, that floor has to be lifted massively, and I think we can all agree on that. The totally spectacular scope for doing that in the relatively near term is what gets me out of bed in the morning. That is what I'm so excited about. And I wish other people could see as clearly as I do the potential there. And then once we've done the hard work of lifting that floor, well, then we'll have plenty of time to have that more difficult and very, you know, the age old philosophical debate about what is equity and equitability and fairness ultimately. But let's do the work we know we can get done right now, which is raise the floor for everybody. And we can do that in truly spectacular fashion if we embrace and accelerate all four of these disruptions, and especially the robotics disruption of labor. At least that's my view. And I'm
I love it so much.
I can bang the drum on this all day long if you let me.
We just might, Adam.
I almost struggle to know, because there are so many things, you know, that I could ask or interject, but each of them seem like a long, you know, discussion all of their own. And so I'm wondering if maybe this is just a good place, at least from my perspective. If we have any more questions that are right here on this topic, we could stay here. But yeah, like things that I think what is the specific character of the type of intelligence that these machines are capable of is a huge driving factor in what is and is not possible and the timeline that those things happen over. And so that's definitely one of the areas that I spent a lot of time talking about. And it seems like it's just kind of an assumption of the RethinkX research is that it's going to, like, the intelligence piece of it is basically on this unstoppable progress curve of its own that will give us nearly limitless capability over that, you know, say 20-year time horizon. It's like, I guess you kind of assume artificial general intelligence is something that we achieve in that time frame. I guess, yeah, how are you thinking about that, if there's a short answer to it that doesn't take us well beyond the time that we have left?
Well, I think that the quickest answer I can give to that is that a very large portion of the tasks that are done at the base of the economy, so the production of raw, just base physical goods, right? It probably does not require fully sentient, fully sapient, agentic intelligence of the general kind. I think that's a safe assumption. Now, that could be false. It could be the case, for example, that some tasks, particularly challenging example of a profession that looks like it might be very difficult to automate is plumbing, for example, right? Because every single task is still the right unit of analysis, but every job site that a plumber arrives at and has to address, has to understand, has to problem solve within is a bespoke, a unique situation, virtually without exception. The sheer number of possible ways that plumbing can go wrong seems fairly simple, but the sheer number of ways that it can go wrong and what has to be done in the specific circumstances of that physical environment is daunting, right? So plumbing is often held up as an example of something that will be very difficult for robots to do. And I think that that's reasonable. I think that that's fair. It's an uncontrolled environment. Every situation is bespoke. Every situation is unique. And the stakes are potentially pretty high. Plumbing damage to a building is no joke. Water damage to a building is no joke. So stakes are high. Uniqueness and the possibility space is very, very large. And so you could argue, not only do you need full generality in order to successfully deploy solutions in that kind of situation, you might need to be agentic. You might need to actually be self-aware and be sapient in order to successfully perform all of the tasks that a plumber has to perform. And so one might argue from that will not be automatable with narrow artificial intelligence, non-agentic, non-sentient AI. That one could argue that, and I'm open to that being persuaded that that's the case. But what I remain quite bullish on is the idea that the overwhelming majority of tasks that are necessary to produce this superabundance of material prosperity that we talked about, in other words, to produce most of the material goods, not all of the services, but most of the material goods that ultimately are the foundation for a prosperous, high quality of life for human beings, that will not require full agentic, sapient, artificial general intelligence. Rather, it will require a modest additional increment of capability beyond, for example, what we already see instantiated in autonomous vehicles. That's my guess, is that you won't need a whole lot more brains than what it takes to drive a car safely to work in a retail store or a warehouse or most factories, if not all factories, and restaurants and in domestic applications, you know, cleaning and folding laundry, as far as I was saying, and the other those sorts of examples. My guess is that fully agentic, sapient, artificial general intelligence is not necessary to be able to successfully complete the overwhelming majority of those tasks. Now, I'm open to being wrong here. Could be wrong, but judging by the spectacular performance we're already seeing in these early days of the capability of these bots, and combined with the really pretty extraordinary capability of generative AI and language models, and we're quite certain that those are not sapient. There's some debate, but we're quite certain that they're not. My guess is that we're safe in assuming the disruption of labor will proceed purely on the basis of incremental increase in capability and this plummeting of cost down the cost curve, and that there isn't going to be a fundamental bottleneck on AGI of the sapient kind that's going to derail or you know, forestall the disruption at some, you know, in some fundamental sense. That's where I've landed for now. But the facts are coming fast and furious, and I could be proven wrong. But for right now, my money is on this disruption is going to proceed and it's not going to take much more artificial intelligence than we've already got.
Adam, give us a plug. Where can people find you? Tell us about your book, Rethink X. Come on, bro. Give us everything. Where this was incredible. This was incredible. Give us everything.
Rethinkx.com is our website. Big props to my entire team, our founders, Tony Seba and James Arby. They make the work that I do possible. It's an incredible privilege. So find out about us on the web, rethinkx.com. We're on X and / Twitter. I've got a video series specifically about the topics in my book, which does talk about robotics and the disruption of labor and their implications for environmental issues. So if you're worried about how we solve some of our big environmental challenges like climate change, there is content on YouTube about that and in the book. And we are putting out, we have a new, and I think it will be quite interesting and significant, major report on energy shortly, so later this summer. So keep an eye out for that. People will find that interesting. And I am now, I've been thinking about it for a decade, but we're just entering into this disruption of labor by AI and robotics domain. We finally planted a flag in the ground here. So this is only the beginning of the work that I'm doing and the conversations I want to have about robotics. So let's make sure this is just the first of many.
Yes, sir. We'll have you back. Probably a lot sooner than all of us think. Keep talking about this stuff.
This was great. This was fun.
Dude, it was awesome. It's such a good talk. I'm going to end the recording right here.